Amory and 107.5 FM W298DK Amory. And always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is a special report from ABC News. I'm Chuck Sievertson. A deadly mass shooting and fire during a service today at a Mormon church in Grand Blanc, Michigan, near Flint. Police say the gunman crashed his car through the church's front doors, opened fire, and set a fire. Cops arrived and shot him dead. He was 40. Grand Blanc Police Chief William Rennie says a second person has died at the hospital. Several others are injured. The church has partially collapsed.
We do believe that there was people up there that were near that fire, and they were unable to get out of the church. So we do believe that we will find additional victims.
And
the FBI, you know, they're devoting 100 agents to this area because, as you can imagine, there's a lot of witnesses that were within the church, and that is a lot of witness information, statements that we have to obtain.
Police say hundreds of people were in the church. This is ABC News. An emergency after floods devastated the rural town of Globe, Arizona, about 90 miles east of Phoenix. Several people are dead. The search is on for others missing. ABC's Melissa Adan.
Businesses wiped out. Paul Kempton, owner of Kempton's Physical Therapy, losing everything.
Not so good. It's about 3 inches full of mud and water about halfway up the wall, and all the equipment has been underwater. To us, it looks like a complete loss.
Officials in Gila County say 3 people were killed. Back in Globe, the mayor saying the main focus is search and rescue operations, and then the recovery.
After 12 years in an Egyptian prison, a pro-democracy Egyptian-British activist has been sprung. Alab Abid Fattah has been freed on a presidential pardon, says his sister on social media. He got caught up in a crackdown on rare anti-government protests in Egypt. Chuck Sievertson, ABC News.
Where working people come to talk. It's the Rick Smith Show, weeknights at 9 on the Civic Media Radio Network. Join me for an honest approach to the issues American working families care about. No talking points, no focus groups. Get ready for a heavy dose of democracy, fairness, grit, and no apologies. It's current affairs from a working class labor perspective. Facts are center, science is real, and everyone gets a seat at the table. The Rick Smith Show, weeknights at 9 on the Civic Media Radio Network.
The Todd Allbaugh Show.
We don't always agree politically, but Bill McCosh.
Thanks for having me. You want to talk Brewers first?
It's been a really special season, and it's not whether you're wearing red or blue hats. It's yellow and blue.
How do you come together in politics? This is one of the ways.
Yeah.
Find some common ground and then expand on that. And right. Then you got to listen to the other side.
Our neighbors are not our enemies. We can disagree politically, but still find ways to bring our community together.
The Todd Allbaugh Show. Weekdays 2 to 4 on your local Civic Media radio station. And on the app.
Farm news that impacts you and your community from the Midwest Farm Report throughout your day on 107.5 WLAK.
For Civic Media News, I'm Savannah Tomei Olson. Wisconsinites are getting loud about how proposed utility rate hikes would impact their lives. Judith Ruiz Branch reports.
Alliant Energy, Xcel Energy, and Madison Gas and Electric filed applications with the Public Service Commission of Wisconsin to increase their electric rates in 2026 and 2027, citing a need for infrastructure upgrades. Xcel customers like 60-year-old Thomas Burhan of Superior have already been grappling with how to keep up with rising costs. Burhan, who is disabled and lives on a fixed income, says his energy was already shut off earlier this year after he fell behind on payments.
It may be only $16 or $18, but that money could be spent for a medication that I need, for groceries, in many other better ways.
Xcel Energy electric rates would increase by more than 11% next year and by about 7% in 2027. Burhan voices strong frustration about the disparities between Xcel Energy executives' compensation and the financial struggles of ordinary Wisconsin residents. In 2024, Xcel Energy CEO Bob Frenzel made $12.7 million, according to Salary.com.
I could live off that 1 hour's work very comfortably for a month and have money to burn. And that's what is so infuriating. They have no idea what it's like for the common people in Wisconsin.
Public Service Commission hearings for Xcel Energy took place earlier this month. PSC says it will make a decision on all 3 utility rate cases later this year. For Wisconsin News Connection, I'm Judith Ruiz Branch. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Savannah Tomei Olson.
You're listening to 107.5 WLAK, Amory's home for mornings with Pat Kreitlow, weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. Sunny skies and mid-70s for your Sunday with light south winds of 5 to 10. Tonight, a clear sky, lower 50s, or winds stay on the light side. Monday promises to be warmer. We'll see sunshine once again, a southerly breeze, highs of the lower 80s. Currently 74 degrees.
Pete Schwabba.
On the next Nightlight, I welcome comedian Mike Lucas and director, producer, and founder of Wisconsinology.com, Frank Anderson. Thank God it's Monday. Let's light it up.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba. Weeknights from 6 till 8.
You're listening to Lake Air WLAK, Amory's home for Matt and Air on Air.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
Welcome to Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel, Civic Media's weekly review and discussion of some of the most significant news stories in the areas of law, government, courts, and the aspiration for justice. And now, here's your host, Jim Santel.
This is the second hour of our weekly weekend broadcast about all things related to the rule of law in America, the administration of justice, and things related to those all-important principles, including things related to criminal process, constitutional procedure, all of that wrapped up in what is always turning into our civics class, our law school class. Again, necessary to understand what's going on here. Spend some time in the first hour talking about the things the government is now obliged to prove. The U.S. attorney, through her own work, through that of other people in the office, have now got to present ultimately to a trial jury in the public domain evidence, not only that the statement that James Comey made about not providing, not offering this tip up, not encouraging someone else to engage in the media, that that was false, that he knew it was false. And again, this materiality notion that it's got to somehow be a statement that would have influenced the outcome in this case. The presentation to the Senate Judiciary Committee back in September 2020. What did that misstatement, assuming it is, that false statement do to change the course materially, significantly? How did it matter when it comes to the representations being made allegedly falsely by James Comey? That's now the government's proof. That's their burden that they've got to establish at a trial. James Comey doesn't have to present anything at all in the pretrial proceedings or in the trial itself. Let's talk about what happens next. Well, this case has been assigned now to a judge. He is a federal district court judge. He is there in Eastern Virginia, not in Washington, D.C. He's in Alexandria. And his name is Michael Nachmanoff, N-A-C-H-M-A-N-O-F-F. And Judge Nachmanoff has already scheduled an arraignment for October 9th. That's going to be a busy week in American history once again, also the week in which the Supreme Court reconvenes for a number of oral arguments. Again, right across the river there in Alexandria, we'll have James Comey and his lawyers are going to be appearing in a federal court, and that is for the arraignment. He will almost certainly plead not guilty. And we may get some sense there of the things that will happen next, the plans of the defendant to not only defend against this case, but to do so vigorously. We know that James Comey has already gone on social media not only to invoke the words of his daughter at the time of her condemnation of this president's actions and of the Department of Justice, but also to offer to all of us that we keep faith, and offering in many ways the notion that he understands what this is, that this is a political prosecution, that there's no there. That's his position. That's what he will plead not guilty. That's the reason why he will enter that not guilty plea on October 19th at that arraignment. Now, what else is going to happen? What else he's going to do through his attorneys in between now and then and the days after that. A number of different options here. I bemoan the fact already that this particular very skeletal indictment doesn't give us a lot of insight into who these people are. Person one, person three, we've got a sense of that based upon news reports at or around the same time, giving you some thoughts about that, but could entirely be different. And the government is obliged to provide the defendant, as always, with all the information it has to support the allegations in these two counts in the indictment. And if that information is not clear enough, or if, even if it is, likely the defense, acting on behalf of James Comey, will file a motion for what's called a bill of particulars. Particulars. That means just what it sounds like and sounds just like it means. We're asking for a more particular statement of exactly what the nature of this false statement is. How did he obstruct? What is this all about? Tell us in great detail. Identify who these people are, these unidentified people in the indictment, and give us an explanation of, for example, the materiality of this allegedly false statement. Describe that in greater detail. Tell us the reason why it was false. Tell us the reason why your evidence supports, again, probable cause at trial has to be beyond a reasonable doubt. Give us those particular things that are not in this indictment. That's one of the motions that will almost certainly be filed, maybe even before October 9th. Here's the other one that's out there, and it comes basically premised upon all the things that the president, to some extent, the attorney general has said, not only in history, but also recently. And they're the statements from a president who plainly is pursuing this, again, plainly, unmistakably, because of the animosity, the political animosity between him and James Comey that goes back to the days when James Comey was the FBI director in the first Trump administration. Comey's indictment is problematic for the government for these reasons, perhaps even more than all this materiality and false statement and knowledge issue that I've already discussed. Comey's lawyers very likely are going to seek a motion, are going to present a motion, and going to seek the dismissal of this case for what? For selective prosecution. For selective prosecution. That, the notion that the case is being and the defendants being improperly targeted for an impermissible reason. Not because the facts and the law support allegations beyond a reasonable doubt by probable cause, but because there's something else that's not related to the rule of law, not related to justice, not related to the facts and the application of the law to that. And that is selective prosecution when you are identifying a prosecution of this defendant despite others who might be similarly situated who are not being charged. Now, that's part of the possibility here. The other portion of it, also deriving from all these things that our president has said, is that the president's statements themselves suggest an animus that proceeds through this investigation and prompted the very presentation of this indictment to the grand jury, going to make a lot of hay out of the fact that Eric Siebert, the former U.S. attorney, looked at all of this. His colleagues there in the U.S. attorney's office looked at all of this. FBI special agents looked at all of this and said there's no there. The president installs a loyalist from the White House in that position, and within days, frankly, hours, an indictment is returned. That is information that the defense is going to raise. It is procedure. It is a part of history, and it underscores their position that this prosecution is not premised upon law and facts, that, in fact, the government can't prove those four elements. Beyond that, that this is simply an animation. This is political retribution, and you'll hear that word in their motion. Donald Trump's own remarks are going to loom large in this presentation, this defensive presentation by the defense counsel. Nothing wrong with that at all. You seize them from the public domain, whether it's on CNN or Fox News or the New York Times or the Los Angeles Times, wherever it is, reliable news sources confirming from the president's lips themselves, from his own mouth, the things that he has said about James Comey. Over the weekend, for example, the
The president preemptively declared on social media that James Comey and Letitia James and Senator Schiff were all, in his words, guilty as hell. But nothing is going to be done. He's bemoaning the fact that nothing is done before this indictment is returned. Prejudicial statement like that is going to loom large, as are many others. It's going to be featured in their motion to dismiss for, call it what you will, prosecutorial misconduct, governmental misconduct, pursuit of the rule of law in a way that's inconsistent with our fundamental standards under a constitutional system. Featured in that motion, undeniably accusing, telling the world, telling the Department of Justice that it is taking part in an improperly vindictive and retributive prosecution. That's what this is about, not based upon justice. That's going to be the principal motion here. Speaking to reporters in the Oval Office on Thursday, Donald Trump insisted that he had no control of the prosecution, none whatsoever. Well, he shouldn't be talking about this at all. The wall, again, between the White House and the Department of Justice has not only been broken down, it's been destroyed. With overt statements by our attorney general, by the president, that is gone. That has animated the administrations of all previous presidents, with the exception of Donald Trump in his first term. Here's what the president said. He said, I can't tell you what's going to happen because I don't know, although he signaled that he wants his attorney general. He wants his newly installed U.S. attorney, used to be there in the West Wing, to do his bidding. He said this, I can only say that Comey is a bad person. He's a sick person. I think he's a sick guy, actually. And in fact, the history of this, the watershed moment, happens about 7 hours later, when James Comey is indicted. That is a set of facts, historical things that are going to be presented by the defense to show that this is an illegitimate prosecution, asking Judge Nachmanoff to get rid of it, to dismiss the case entirely, anticipate that coming in addition to requesting more information, the bill of particulars. And here's the other portion of this. Here's the other portion of all of this. James Comey has said, let's go. He wants a fast trial. Now, you know, because we've talked about this before, that under the federal system, there is a thing called the Speedy Trial Act. It requires, believe it or not, that every single criminal case be tried within 70 days after an initial appearance, after the case begins. Now, that's very, very often not violated, but the judges often find bases upon which to extend that, to find what's called excludable time for motions pending. You've got to resolve those. All sorts of other things under the law properly invoked by the parties, by the prosecution, by defense counsel, by the judge herself or himself, to find that that 70-day period cannot be met. Nothing wrong with that. That's legal. In the Eastern District of Virginia, where this case is prosecuted, there's also a thing called the rocket docket. And yes, it's a euphemism for a very expedited process. And again, with all sorts of trappings related to it, it's in the local rules over and beyond what's in the Speedy Trial Act. There is contemplation, again, upon invocation by a defendant. I want my case tried even more quickly. I want my case tried within 30 days. 30 days is the rocket docket in the Eastern District of Virginia. James Comey, in his statement to the world on social media, denying these allegations, invoking once again the important words of his own daughter, talking about his status and being concerned about the future of America, also said, let's go. He is presumably signaling that he, through his attorneys, may ask the judge, Judge Nachmanoff, to schedule this on for a very quick trial. Let's go. Yes, we need to get all the discovery. We need to get that bill of particulars. And yes, we're going to file our motion for improper prosecution, inappropriate prosecutorial conduct here, executive involvement in a way that it should not be. But also, let's pick a jury. Let's go ahead before the end of the year and try this case. It's not that complicated, he's saying. And we can identify in this very narrow allegation the singular thing that I said, that I did not authorize the release of this information to the media. Let's focus on that. It'll probably take longer to select a jury than to present whatever the government's evidence is of that. James Comey can take the stand and say also, if he wants to, as is his right, that this didn't happen, and let the jury decide this. He wants to go. And that may also be a part of the strategy that we will see here. Ultimately, Judge Nachmanoff is the one who decides that. And he is the one who makes the determination in the end. But that's upcoming. That's upcoming. When we come back, we'll talk more about the implications of all of this, not only for this particular case, but for America, this watershed event in our history that happened just this past week. All of that coming up on Amicus, a Law Review.
This is Lake Air 1260 AM WLAK.
Are unauthorized immigrants eligible for federal Medicaid coverage? No. Unauthorized immigrants are not eligible for traditional federally funded Medicaid health insurance and never have been. A 1996 law also requires most authorized immigrants to wait 5 years for eligibility. 14 states, not including Wisconsin, use state funds to cover unauthorized immigrants. President Trump has proposed cutting federal Medicaid funds to those states, which could drop 1.4 million people from health care coverage. In Wisconsin, Medicaid covers 1.28 million people at a cost of $12.1 billion. I'm Tricia Young for Wisconsin Watch. Fact briefs are bite-sized fact checks of trending claims produced by Wisconsin Watch and GigaFact. Learn more at wisconsinwatch.org.
Get ready to go for the green and gold on this local civic media radio station. Listen each weekday for the keywords to text for your chance to win our daily prize, $200 cash and gold jewelry. And be entered to win our grand prize, two indoor club level seats to see the green and gold take on Minnesota in Green Bay.
The WLAK Go for the Green and Gold text win contest is powered by Amory Chevrolet. Lifetime warranty, trusted service, hometown values. Amory Chevrolet, where people matter most.
At Hazelden Betty Ford, treating mental health isn't just about breaking old patterns. It's about braving new ones. As the leader in alcohol and drug treatment for 75 years, we know caring for addiction, anxiety, depression, and trauma goes hand in hand. We're here for you with new tools when life breaks down at our new clinic in Hudson. Discover your path to better mental health at HazeldenBettyFord.org/Hudson. Sponsored by Hazelden Betty Ford Foundation.
We are the National Park Foundation, and together with you, we're creating a future where every person, every generation, gets their chance at an unforgettable moment. Learn more at nationalparks.org/foundation.
Come work with us. Civic Media has a number of great jobs across the state. Open now at civicmedia.us/careers.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
My name is Jim Santel. This is Amicus, a Law Review, spending a good deal of time on this event in American history. Just recently, the indictment by a federal grand jury in Eastern Virginia of James Comey, describing what's going on in that case, but then getting to the larger implications of this, including the connection between the president of the United States of America and these charges. We have spoken about that at great length in the past. This notion ever since Watergate, since 1973, 1974, Watergate reforms, establishing norms by which a president should not be able to command, to direct the prosecution of people in America. Why? Because you want that to be based upon the facts and the law, want that to be done by people who are experts, who know what they're doing, want grand juries to make determinations premised upon the facts and the law, do not want it to be infected by political animus, unlike what's going on here. And indeed, in addition to the things the president has said about James Comey prior to this indictment, we know that right after the return of the indictment, once again, he cannot be quiet. He posts on his social media outlet, "Justice in America," all capital letters, exclamation point. Justice in America, celebrating the notion, which I've always described as human tragedy. Any prosecution in America, regardless of who it is, what the circumstances are, it is all human tragedy. It is necessary,
Absolutely, as a part of our law enforcement process, but it is human tragedy. My president celebrates this justice in America. Also, of course, understanding and underscoring that he is directing what's going on at the Department of Justice, not only to Pam Bondi, not only to his former attorney, Todd Blanche, the deputy attorney general, not only to his newly installed U.S. attorney in Eastern Virginia, who went into the grand jury and at his bidding got the very thing the president wanted, which is an indictment against his adversary, James Comey. All of that will be presented in motions asking the judge in Eastern Virginia to get rid of this case. Who is this judge? Well, he has been on the bench for a few years, former federal public defender, former magistrate judge there who does a lot of the pretrial work. Interestingly, just about of his history, a footnote to all of this, again, going back to the time of the first Trump impeachment proceeding. This is the judge who also handled the arraignments, just as he will do on October 9th, of James Comey. He handled the arraignments of these two fellows, Lev Parnas and Igor Fruman. Remember them? Lev Parnas and Igor Fruman. They were charged with funneling these foreign funds into U.S. elections. He handled the arraignments of those two and other proceedings, other cases, during his time plainly on the bench there in Eastern Virginia. He is going to be presiding over the arraignment on October 9th. That's the time when James Comey will come in with his attorneys. It may be a completely uneventful proceeding covered plainly, hugely, by the media on that day. But we may also get some hints, again, about what the defense strategy is here. It's entirely possible they may ask the judge, invoking the rocket docket, invoking the Speedy Trial Act, to say, "Judge, we would like this case to be tried before the end of the year. We'd like it to go quickly. Let's go to trial. Let's present this case. It's relatively straightforward. It's skeletal in nature. It has to do with the exchange of a question and an answer by this defendant, and we'll figure out whether or not it was material, whether it was false, whether or not the defendant knew it. Let's make the government prove that case. Let's go ahead." They may do that. They may also file motions, again, selective prosecution, vindictive prosecution, inappropriate animus for a prosecution, all of that asking the judge to dismiss it. A bill of particulars as well, asking Judge Nachmanoff to do all of that. We'll see what happens. That may indeed happen, some of that, even before October 9th. What happens in addition to all of this that adds force to this notion that we are now in this authoritarian state in America, as evidenced by the fact that now our president, after threatening investigations, opening investigations of people, has now begun at his direction to indict people who he does not like. And in that connection, we know that even while all this is going on, other things coming out of the White House, Justice Department officials pushing prosecutors around the nation to investigate George Soros's foundation. Senior Justice Department official has confirmed that about a half dozen U.S. attorney's offices have been directed to draft plans to investigate a group funded by George Soros. He is the Democratic donor. He's a billionaire who has demanded that he be thrown in jail. Those U.S. attorneys in various places like California, New York, Washington, District of Columbia, Chicago, Detroit, and Maryland, all of that at the encouragement of this Justice Department, open investigations, see what you've got, because the president wants George Soros investigated. We know as well, late breaking news, that the Trump administration is also seeking information on Fannie Willis. Remember her from the Georgia prosecution? They've subpoenaed records related to her travel history. She is the Georgia DA once again who charged the president with a sweeping election interference case. That's the RICO case. The scope of that investigation is not clear, but that happened also. The president has also indicated and said in the public domain all sorts of hugely critical and condemning things about Fannie Willis. And then there's this. The president has also ordered, with the deputy attorney general and the attorney general right behind him, this past Thursday with the FBI also there. He's ordering what he called a broad effort to root out groups, he says, organized political violence. President Trump announcing that he wants the Department of Justice to investigate what he claimed were rich people and organizations funding left-wing political violence around the country. He tells the authorities, tells the folks in the FBI, the Justice Department, and the Treasury Department to find and prosecute activity, the institutional and individual funders, officers, and employees of organizations that are responsible for criminal conduct. All of those accusations akin to the things he has said to James Comey, also a part of the authoritarian regime that is now in place, clearly, unmistakably, as of this week. When we come back, we'll tell you more about that here on Amicus, a Law Review.
You're listening to Lake Air, WLAK, Amory's home for Nightlight with Pete Schwabba.
107.5 WLAK, Amory's real news and great conversation, and home to Mornings with Pat Kreitlow.
This is a special report from ABC News. I'm Chuck Sievertson. A deadly mass shooting and fire during a service today at a Mormon church in Grand Blanc, Michigan, near Flint. Police say the gunman crashed his car through the church's front doors, opened fire, and set a fire. Cops arrived and shot him dead. He was 40. Grand Blanc Police Chief William Rennie says a second person has died at the hospital. Several others are injured. The church has partially collapsed.
We do believe that there was people up there that were near that fire, and they were unable to get out of the church. So we do believe that we will find additional victims.
And?
The FBI, you know, they're devoting 100 agents to this area because, as you can imagine, there's a lot of witnesses that were within the church, and that is a lot of witness information, statements that we have to obtain.
Police say hundreds of people were in the church. This is ABC News.
The Packers on Sunday Night Football. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with Sports in Dallas, where the Packers are playing the Cowboys tonight. Green Bay began the season with convincing wins over the Lions and Commanders, but lost last week in Cleveland to a Browns team that hadn't won a game since last November. I spoke to Packers tight end Tucker Kraft about the start of their season so far.
You know, we did great week one, week two, coming out, trying to put points on the board. We just got to stick to that. It doesn't matter if we're home or away. We're going to come out on the first drive and try to get points on the board. That is just the demand of our offense. The defense needs us to play like that so we can play complementary to them. They hold the team to 13 points in the fourth quarter. It was 10-0 up until the fourth quarter. That's remarkable. Not a lot of defenses are doing that. We have the best defense in the NFL. So we have to help them out.
That's Packers tight end Tucker Kraft with Sports on Mike Clemens.
On your entertainment beat, I'm Pete Schwabba. The president has tons of critics in or out of the entertainment business, but none have been as harsh as Bruce Springsteen. The boss has written about blue-collar America for most of his career and professed his love for his country in a recent interview with Time magazine. Springsteen hit the president pretty hard during his tour last spring. The boss does not seem intimidated, even though the president has him by 3 years, about 150 pounds, and is beating him in bankruptcies, 6-0. Not to mention he is also leading when it comes to telling someone not to certify election results. Be that as it may, the boss has a lot more kick-butt tunes. All the president could come up with in response to Springsteen's harsh criticism was, "He's dumb as a rock." This from the guy who can't pronounce acetaminophen. In the interview with Time, Springsteen probably realized he couldn't match wits and just said he couldn't care less what the president thinks. For more showbiz fun, tune into Nightlight with me, Pete Schwabba, weeknights from 6 to 8 p.m. on the Civic Media Radio Network.
107.5 WLAK, Amory's real news and great conversation.
And home to Matt and Air on Air, weekday mornings from 9 to 11.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. Clear tonight, lows around 50. Sunny, low 80s for Monday. Monday night, mostly cloudy and lows in the upper 50s. On Tuesday, mostly cloudy, a high near 81. A little bit of sun on Wednesday with highs in the upper 70s. Sunshine Thursday, 81.
Currently 75 degrees.
I'm Dan Schaefer. Let's recombobulate. Tom Tiffany, the Republican congressman representing Wisconsin's 7th Congressional District, has finally made it official. He's running for governor. The election for governor in 2026 is the state's first open race for the office since 2010, and it's sure to invite many candidates to run. And on the Republican side, Tiffany's is the most significant announcement yet. There's a very good chance that he is going to be the Republican nominee for governor at this time next year. If that proves to be the case, it would signify a major shift in the center of power for Republican politics in Wisconsin. For so long, it's been the WOW counties, Waukesha, Ozaukee, and Washington, three of the counties that surround Milwaukee, that have been the Republican stronghold in the state. But if Tiffany is the one on the top of the ticket, it will be the most clear indicator yet of how the party has shifted from more of a suburban one to one where GOP voters are more centered in exurban or rural areas.
Find all of Dan's work at the Recombobulation Area and on our website at civicmedia.us.
Todd Albaugh.
She's a broadcasting legend in Wisconsin, and we're lucky enough to have her here at Civic Media. We start our new segment. Jane Matinere joins us for Matinere Mondays. Next time, join us.
The Todd Albaugh Show, weekdays 2 to 4.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
My name is Jim Santel. This is Amicus, a Law Review. We are spending the great majority of our time talking about this watershed event in American history. That is the indictment of James Comey, not only in and of itself important, but for the message it sends to all of us concerned about the rule of law and the conduct of the president, who is not only reaching into but directing the Department of Justice when it comes to the prosecution of people in the United States of America. Right now, it is James Comey. There are others plainly on his list. He has denied that there is a list, but he's identified people like George Soros and Fannie Willis and other groups out there, Letitia James, Adam Schiff, others who have also been his adversaries over the course of the past decade or so. They may also fall prey to this kind of abuse of the system, abuse by an authoritarian government. We appreciate so very much the conduct of those people in our government who may push back on this kind of thing, including federal judges, including grand juries, including prosecutors who are saying no. That is the continuing struggle. They are the guardrails that continue to push back on this kind of behavior. That is not to say that it is not here at the same time. We also appreciate very much those of you who offer questions, inquiries, comments, and that includes Mark. You've been on the line for a while, Mark. Thanks for joining us here on our broadcast. Go ahead.
Hello. Yeah, yes. Yeah. The animus, at least for James Comey, at least traces all the way back to, I would say, back to 2017 when Comey refused to drop the investigation of Michael Flynn
right.
and Paul Manafort, both of whom were actually convicted of playing footsie with the Russians, to put it mildly, playing footsie with them. You know, that Trump has maintained there's been no connection between him and the Russians, and it's certainly belied by that fact that those two men were actually convicted, and you know, he says the Russia thing is just a hoax. Well, apparently, I don't think it actually was a hoax. I don't think the Mueller report would indicate that was a hoax. But the animus here is just clear that he's going against all these people and the tragedy. And Comey's doing things right, demanding his Sixth Amendment right to a speedy trial. But the problem is that Trump has unlimited funds to go after these people, and you can pauperize the people he is going after because of this animus he has, and you just keep going after them, and these people do not have unlimited funds to defend themselves, which they need to have first-class defense to defend themselves in these cases, and the crime here is that these people are going to be out of pocket for this amount of money. And that Donald Trump can just keep going on and on like he has done his entire bloody life, that he has gone after, used the courts to his advantage.
I couldn't agree more, Mark. And again, your point is the one we've also made in the past, that let us assume, as many people are predicting on all sides of political aisle these days, that this case is going to fall apart, whether it's on pretrial matters or goes to trial. We don't know for sure, but it certainly is a flawed prosecution. Your point is all important. Thank you for making it once again on this edition of our show. That is that the investigation itself, the prosecution itself,
even if it doesn't result in a conviction, that is the retribution. That is the punishment. The investigation is the punishment, not only for James Comey, who, yes, probably has the resources to bring forth attorneys who will do an excellent job in defending him. But what about all those other people whose names are not on the list that I just described here? Those other people we have described, identified by this president, maybe down the road, who do not have the resources to rally all of this legal defense. For them, once again, not only in the public domain, your name is splashed all over the media. You have been indicted. You're under investigation. The investigation, the charges themselves are indeed the punishment. That's the retribution. And if a conviction comes, that's just an addition to it. In the unlikely event that there is a conviction, that also pursues or advances further the president's inappropriate pursuit of this kind of activity. But the investigation, what's going on right now, Mark, could not agree with you more on that and the other issues that you've identified. Thank you so much for being a part of our broadcast this morning. So let's talk about all of that, the things Mark's identifying. Authoritarianism, there is an awful lot, of course, written out there about that. There is a pretty seminal writing way back in 1964 by a fellow named Juan Linz, L-A-N-Z. He talks about an authoritarian regime. He says there are four different things. Limited political pluralism, that is, you're stopping people from having diversity in thought in politics. You're stopping the community, if you will, of discussion that should be a part of a pluralistic society by constraining what? The legislature, parties, your own entities, your departments of justice, interest groups, stopping people from doing the things that they are obliged to do. And yes, using them for your own purposes. A second thing is legitimacy based upon appeals to emotion and proposing to the people who are listening to you, your constituencies, that the people you're going after are bad guys, for example, as the president has said. Identifying problems, insurgency, emergencies, all kinds of things that mandate this kind of authoritarian behavior. Suppression of anti-executive and anti-regime activities. Suppression of people like James Comey and Letitia James and George Soros and all these other folks, people who are perceived as your enemies, if you will, in the public domain, in politics, and suppressing them by, yes, investigating them, prosecuting them, and all these ill-defined executive powers, taking upon yourself some vague and often shifting authorities that you do not have. We'll get to that in just a moment or so. All those kinds of things and more, referencing history and referencing what people who know these kinds of things have identified as an authoritarian government. I have said repeatedly that on March 15th, we entered into a constitutional crisis. That was the day upon which the government of the United States of America began to dissemble and began to lie to a judge named James Boasberg about those 238 people who were loaded onto planes and sent off to El Salvador. They're still there, with the exception of one of them, who is brought back again under very, very troubling circumstances. On that day and going forward, the government, your U.S. attorneys, and your prosecutors in the federal courts in the District of Columbia in front of James Boasberg have lied, have misrepresented, as have other lawyers in that same regime, if you will, including lawyers who appeared in front of Judge Zinnes in Maryland and others around the nation. We know that that's going on as well. And we know that that has been the constitutional crisis of one entity of the government saying no to the other. That's no longer checks and balances. That is no longer simply pursuing an appeal. That is discarding the very mechanisms by which our government is checked and balanced. The separation of powers brought to its knees. That's the constitutional crisis we have been in ever since March 15th, that Saturday when we began to lie to a federal district court judge, repeated in many other circumstances since then. This past Thursday, we now slip into authoritarianism by virtue of the fact that we have now permitted the president of the United States of America to take over the Department of Justice, to direct that his political enemies be prosecuted on cases and under facts that, again, are certainly subject to an awful lot of skepticism about whether or not the government can prove this, whether this is at all a merit-based prosecution. That is the subject of what will go forward here, but certainly the product of prosecutorial animus and misconduct at the direction, at the hands of a president who should have nothing to do with the Department of Justice. You do not want any of your decisions about who's prosecuted and isn't prosecuted in the District of Columbia, in the districts of Wisconsin, in California, in Texas, in Florida, the 93 districts, those have got to be independent of politics and partisan views. And if a president is involved in the decision-making about who and what and where and for what purposes a defendant or a series of defendants are indicted, your system is lost. That is the authoritarianism about which I speak today. And that is the reason why we mark September 25th, like March 15th, as another watershed day in American history, even as our country continues to wrestle with these great challenges of law and order and of rule of law and of justice that we should all expect from a government that is here to serve and support all of us. That's the authoritarianism in which we have slipped, into which we have slipped just this past week. This past week also saw the issuing by the Supreme Court of a number of additional decisions of great consequence. Let me identify just a couple of those and then speak in particular about this major decision involving, yes, what I'm going to encourage this broadcast and next broadcast for you to understand and put in your lexicon, this notion that Humphrey's executor is now on the chopping block. We'll explain that in just a moment or so. We know that just this past week, a couple of things happened before the Supreme Court, including the decision by the administration. Yes, now it's before the Supreme Court, the Trump administration asking the Supreme Court formally to allow the end of birthright citizenship. Not resolved by the Supreme Court on June 30th, the Supreme Court now being asked by the president to determine that if you're born here, but you're born here of a mother, parents who are not legally here or here temporarily, you are not a citizen, overturning well over 100 years of precedent in this nation under the 14th Amendment. The administration asking the Supreme Court just this past week to review that case, and late this past week allowing Donald Trump to slash foreign aid, allowing the Trump administration to withhold $4 billion with a B in foreign aid that was appropriated by the Congress. Again, even as the lower courts continue to wrestle with this issue, another case involving the shadow docket, three liberal justices dissenting, of course, including Elena Kagan. She says the stakes are high. At issue is the allocation of power between the executive and the Congress over how government funds are spent. She's joined, of course, by Sonia Sotomayor and Ketanji Brown Jackson. And we have another instance where, while the lower courts are continuing to wrestle with this issue about whether or not the president's withholding $4 billion in foreign aid appropriated by the Congress as a part of our constitutional process, whether he can unilaterally cut that funding and what the potential impact of that may well be, the Supreme Court going ahead and saying, sure, go ahead and do just that, at least while the case continues to go forward. The order is, again, technically interviewed, but have broad consequences, right? They allow the administration to remove protections for hundreds of immigrants in other cases, to fire independent government regulators, to remove transgender groups from the military, people from the military, all of that. About 22, 23, 24 of these cases being decided on the shadow docket, including once again, just this past week, this major case involving the Federal Trade Commission. Federal Trade Commission, again, significantly established, as you all well know, because we have talked about this, we've wrestled with this in the public domain. It is a congressionally established independent agency. The commissioners do not sit around the cabinet table with the president in the cabinet room. They are independent, created by the Congress to be independent. Why? Because their commission to enforce consumer protection laws and antitrust laws and all sorts of things related to the trade in America, all kinds of things that are important and should not be subject to partisan engagement, all of those things independent of the president. And indeed, it's Humphrey's executor that said that. Humphrey's executor that said that in the annals of history. How does this case come about? How does this particular case, we're going to call slaughter, based upon the fact that notwithstanding...
As Wisconsin is cheering on the Brew Crew. This is the Civic Media Radio Network.
I love playing sports, especially for my school. And that's because school sports are special. It's where it's safe to fail. It's where we're taught resilience, where our fear becomes confidence. It's where we learn to get back up after every fall. School sports are where 7.8 million students go from I can't to I can.
This message presented by the WIAA and the Wisconsin Athletic Directors Association.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government by and for the people. Maine voters decide November 4th whether adding more ID and mail-in voting restrictions for most voters justifies preventing almost non-existent voter fraud. Question 1 tightens voter ID requirements and adds hurdles for mail-in voters, including the elderly and disabled, despite only 2 voter fraud convictions since 1982. About half of Maine's over 842,000 2024 voters used a mail-in ballot, and over 16,000 subscribed to an ongoing absentee voter list, according to the state's September 2025 figures. If approved, Question 1 would eliminate the absentee list and prohibit requesting an absentee application by phone. It also prohibits third parties from delivering absentee ballot applications, including family members, and limits drop boxes. Maine's population is the oldest in the U.S., with 21.8% of residents over 65. Question 1 also narrows Maine's voter ID options, eliminating student IDs, tribal IDs, and other currently acceptable documents, despite no evidence of abuse. At almost 75%, Maine consistently has one of the highest voter turnouts in the country, and the Heritage Foundation's own figures show just 2 convictions for voter fraud in over 40 years. We have the text of Question 1 at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org. I'm Brian Beal.
Hi, my name is Chuck Collins. I'm the great-grandson of the meatpacker Oscar Mayer and a member of the Patriotic Millionaires. I'm also the author of a new book, Burned by Billionaires, How Concentrated Wealth and Power are Ruining Our Lives and Planet. This summer proved to all of us that climate change is real and it is deadly. And I'm here to tell you that a small group of billionaires are making it worse. Did you know that billionaire Jeff Bezos's wife, Lauren Sanchez, emitted more carbon in her 11-minute Blue Origin space flight than the average person emits in a lifetime? Did you know that the average super yacht produces as much carbon emissions as 1,500 regular vehicles, and that private jets emit 10 to 20 times more pollutants per passenger than commercial airplanes? So who should pay for climate change? People like you who recycle and turn off the lights when you leave the room, or billionaires who take joyrides in space? Tax the rich, tax the rich, tax the rich. I'm Chuck Collins. I'm a patriotic millionaire, and I approve this message.
As Wisconsin is cheering on Bucky Badger, this is the Civic Media Radio Network.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
My name is Jim Santel. This is Amicus Lawview. Once again, visiting the conduct, the actions of our Supreme Court. Appreciate so much the comment from Jim once again, noting that it is not Americans who are doing this, but it is 6 members of the Supreme Court who are letting the president engage in these kinds of behaviors, giving him the authority to go ahead, even while underlying litigation about firings and allocations of monies and congressional conferences of authorities are being run roughshod over. Jim, appreciate the comment very much coming in from Appleton. What are we talking about? This is the Federal Trade Commission. This is
Slaughter. That is the name of the case. She is the commissioner unilaterally fired by the president of the United States of America in the wake of a case called Humphrey's Executor versus the United States way back in 1935. It's the same circumstance. U.S. Supreme Court decides back then that the U.S. Constitution and indeed the very commission of the Federal Trade Commission allows the Congress to enact a law like the FTC. And what does it do? It limits, it restricts, it prohibits the president from firing executive officials of independent agencies. And we're back here once again. And that is Humphrey's Executor. Next broadcast, I'm going to tell you more about all of the history related to Humphrey's Executor. Keep that in mind. It's going to loom large in this term of the Supreme Court. Lots of people involved in that historically, involving, again, William Humphrey, a president named Calvin Coolidge, another president named Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and disagreements at that time about whether the president can do this. The Supreme Court, in the end, saying no decisively. The president cannot fire commissioners of the Federal Trade Commission, can't do it. And the authority of the president to act in this area is not only limited, it's non-existent. What happens this past week is that the Supreme Court overturns the lower court. Judge Ali Khan overturns the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia that says that the commissioner cannot be fired without the required grounds of inefficiency, neglect of duty, or malfeasance. That's required by the law. That's required by an application of constitutional principles. And the Supreme Court, at the pen of the Chief Justice, John Roberts, once again bemoaned appropriately by Jim and others in America, says, you know what, we're going to stay those lower court decisions. We're going to suspend them. Go ahead. The application to do that by the president is also, we're going to treat this as an application for a writ of certiorari. That's the legal term for, we'll take this up. We're going to take up whether or not this concept in Humphrey's Executor should be revisited. He identifies a couple of questions, whether the statutory removal protections for the Federal Trade Commission commissioners violates the separation of powers, and whether a federal court can prevent this person's removal from public office. Specifically notes whether or not we should now overturn Humphrey's Executor issued by the court in 1935, 90 years ago. It's been the law of the nation for the last nine decades, plainly signaling that this Supreme Court in this coming term on this case is going to overturn this precedent that affirmed 90 years ago the separation of powers in America. Along the way, Justice Kagan, joined by Justices Jackson and Sotomayor, says on top of granting certiorari before judgment is rendered in this case, the lower court, the court today issues a stay enabling the president to immediately discharge without any cause a member of the FTC. This granted our emergency docket just the latest in a series. Earlier this year, she notes, the same majority by the same mechanism permitted the president to fire without cause members of the NLRB, the Merit Systems Protection Board, the Consumer Product Safety Commission. And all of them, she says, are classic independent agencies, multi-member bipartisan commissions whose members have served dutifully. Cannot be removed except for good reason. Yet the majority, she says, stay order has handled full control of those agencies to the president. He may now remove, or so says the majority, for any reason and no reason at all, the people he does not like. And he may thereby extinguish the agency's bipartisanship and independence. She says, I dissented from the majority's prior stay orders, and I do so again today. She says, under existing law, what Congress said goes, as this court unanimously said in 1935 in, yes, remember the name, Humphrey's Executor, rejecting a claim a presidential prerogative identical to the one made in this case. She says, indeed, the suit emerged from a discharge at the very same agency. Congress, we held, may restrict the president's power to remove members of the FTC, as well as other agencies performing quasi-legislative or quasi-judicial functions. So the president cannot, as he concededly did here, fire an FTC commissioner without any reason. To reach a different result, Elena Kagan writes, a different result requires reversing the rule stated in Humphrey's Executor. It entails overriding rather than accepting Congress's judgment about agency design. She goes on to say the majority may be raring to take that action as its grant of certiorari before judgment suggests. We're going to take this on. She says, but until the deed is done, Humphreys controls and prevents the majority from giving the president the unlimited removal power Congress denied him. Because the majority stay does just that, she says, I respectfully dissent. Our emergency docket should never be used, as it has been this year, to permit what our president bars. Still more, she says, it should not be used, as it has also been, to transfer government authority from Congress to the president, and thus to reshape the nation's separation of powers. Watershed event at the Supreme Court this past week that included at least two watershed events in American history. When we come back next week again, I'll tell you more about Humphrey's executor. We'll talk more about the Supreme Court going into business once again. All of that as Amicus on the broadcast stations of Law Review, Amicus Law Review, as we our broadcast stations continue here and inviting you back for more of that conversation. Have a good week, everybody.
You're listening to Lake Air 1260 AM WLAK Amory and 107.5 FM W298DK Amory, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Chuck Sievertson. A second person has died at the hospital after a mass shooting at a Mormon church near Flint, Michigan, says the police chief. Several others injured. The gunman?
He drove his vehicle through the front doors of the church. He then exited his vehicle, firing several rounds at individuals within the church.
Grand Blanc, Michigan Police Chief William Rennie says the gunman then started a fire that heavily damaged the church. Cops arrived and shot him dead. The chief says they expect to find more bodies. A man arrested is accused of pulling up in a boat to a dockside pub in Southport, North Carolina last night and shooting customers, killing three, five others injured. Ending his campaign for another term as New York City Mayor, Eric Adams, citing media speculation and the campaign finance board withholding millions of dollars. The storm drenching the Bahamas has grown into Tropical Storm Imelda. It could head for the Carolinas. This is ABC News. Senate Democrats.